Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. We do have a quorum present, and I would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes of February 19th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Nora moves to approve the minutes of February 19th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. That is the toughest vote you're going to have today. So, you know, relax now. Okay. So, members, I am really excited about the presentation that we're going to have today. I hope, I know we're kind of short on members, and I know that other things are going on in other committees, but I think this is really important for a number of reasons. We are hearing about all kinds of things that are happening in our healthcare marketplace. We're hearing about hospital closures. We're hearing about, changes in, consolidations. We hear about lack of access in some places. We hear about costs going up. And I just thought it would be really helpful to us, first of all, to have the Department of Health come in and kind of do a reset for us on exactly what is going on in the marketplace in Minnesota. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I hope that we'll have some discussion about the what we call the moratorium. Members remember, I think it was in the last session a couple of years ago, we had, right, Representative Schumacher, we had a, and this has happened periodically over the time I've been here, we have a moratorium on a hospital bed. So if a hospital that doesn't have a stockpile of beds wants to expand, they have to come to the legislature and ask for an exception to the moratorium. And in this last round, we found out that the moratorium is has gotten a little bit out of whack. And there was some discussion at that time of maybe doing some revisions. I know we did do a little bit of revision to it in terms of timelines for people to get things in. But I'm hoping that, and I don't have an agenda in particular. I'm not here with a thought about what we should do. But I'm hoping that we can kind of explore that issue and see whether something needs to be changed, and if so, what that might be. And by, kind of examining this issue as a committee, I'm hoping that we can kind of together learn a little bit about what levers of power we have in the situation and whether or what we should be doing. So that's the agenda that I have behind today's meeting. So I would like to call up Stefan Gildemeister from the Department of Health, who's has put together a presentation for us. And Mr. Gildemeister, thank you very much for doing this. I know it's a lot of work to pull all this data together, and I am very interested in what you have to say, and I hope other members are also very interested. I think it will be very enlightening. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. And I am the state health economist, and I direct the health economics program at the Department of Health. I'm excited that you're excited that I will show you some information, so that bodes well. And I'm also pleased that the three things that you mentioned, consolidation, access, and the moratorium, are things that I plan to talk about. Unfortunately, you only gave me 30 minutes. So I will have to choose and prioritize, which I've done in these slides. Of course, I'm happy to follow up with questions that you have and share material. Part of our job in the health economics program is to maintain an up-to-date perspective or view of the healthcare market. So even though I'm choosing to show only certain things, there is more information available.
Okay. And Mr. Gildemeister, I don't know why we gave you 30 minutes, but our intention is to use the entire hearing time for your presentation and questions and discussion. So if you need a little more than a half hour, by all means, and we'll try to hold questions to the end, members, unless there are clarifying questions. And that way we can hopefully have time for a really good discussion at the end. So please continue.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to keep it to 30 minutes, because if you give me the carte blanche, I'm unstoppable. So here So there are a couple of things that I won't be talking about. I won't talk much about healthcare financing. I won't talk much about insurance coverage. I won't talk a lot about differences in healthcare market performance in urban and rural areas. But as I said, we're happy to follow up if there are particular questions. What I want to talk about is start you off with healthcare spending with the latest numbers that we have, talk a little bit about the structure of the healthcare system in Minnesota, walk through a number of challenges, and then, as you requested, talk about some of the tools that policymakers have that you already use and that are available to that others in other states are using, but also touch on the moratorium. So a few numbers. Actually, my presentation is full of numbers. You know, we track healthcare spending. We have tracked healthcare spending since the late 1990s. Not many states have done that. But this has been born out of an interest of this legislative body to have an understanding of what drives healthcare, how it's changing over time, and sort of where there are potential opportunities or interests to engage as policymakers. So in 2017, like virtually every year since we've done this work, we report increased spending. Spending has reached $50 billion, and I've spent about 5 minutes in the internet to look what costs $50 billion, and then I gave up because it was just too complex. It's a lot of money, but it's hard to really appreciate it without context. Just this much, healthcare spending in most years has been growing faster than inflation for other goods and services. So we are spending more than we're earning on an average weekly basis in terms of the growth of the economy, and as I said, also in terms of inflation. So what does that look like, these $53 billion in spending? In 2017, the year for which I'm showing you data, this, if we divide it across the population of Minnesota, it's about $9,000 per person. And if everyone had the median income, it would consume about a quarter of each of our income. So a sizable amount of spending. Interesting also is not surprising, I think, for many of you, is that as healthcare spending has grown, we as consumers have borne a greater share of the burden of that growth. So, for example, spending by individuals through premiums and cost sharing has grown 4.5 times over the past 20 years, whereas spending by health insurance covered services has grown about twice over this period. And then lastly, as we project this forward, looking at separate trends in Medicare, in Medicaid, and in the commercial space, we expect spending to double again, reaching almost $100 billion by 2027, and consuming not 14% of the economy as we reported in 2017, but about 17 or 18%. Now, by itself, high volume in healthcare spending doesn't have to be a bad thing. If it were to translate into extreme health benefits, greater improvement in outcomes, longer life expectancy, could be a good thing. What makes this challenging in Minnesota and across the U.S. is that the increase in value is modest at best, but also that we are observing, as we're spending more of the economy on healthcare, we can spend less on other things like education, fixing potholes, and other things. And while there isn't a objectively right amount of healthcare spending, I think what we as society expect from the healthcare system is what should perhaps drive where we allocate spending and how much we're spending. So it's There isn't a true number to aim for, but there is a set of expectations to define, and then the spending and the quality of spending to zero in on. So where do Minnesotans get health care? It's a complex story, like oftentimes in healthcare, so complex that Microsoft didn't have enough visuals for me to toss on this page. But essentially, you know, there are hospitals, surgery centers, there's imaging facilities focusing on imaging, pharmacies, et cetera. And then not on this list are, on the right-hand side, some emerging areas of care delivery, such as convenience clinics, telemedicine, and freestanding urgency services, but also what we as individuals choose to do with about our health in terms of over-counter medication and homeopathic or alternative care. What makes this more complex, there's fanciness built into these graphs. What makes this system of care delivery more complex is that care is delivered for the same services in different institutions. So the example of outpatient surgery means it's delivered both in hospitals, it's delivered in freestanding surgery centers, imaging can be had across the system, office visits, et cetera. You get the point. What this overlapping delivery of healthcare services means, though, is that it adds complexity in streams of financing, in contracts, in incentives, and confusion for the consumer. Where do I get the best services? How much do I pay for these services? What is the quality of care? What's a regulated entity? What is not? It's a very complex, difficult system for patients and for payers of healthcare services. So the $50 billion, where do they pool up in across the spectrum of care delivery? As you would expect, about a third, and that's been fairly steady, but about a third of healthcare spending is found in hospitals, both through inpatient care for very complex services, but also in outpatient settings, increasingly because hospitals are investing in outpatient departments. About 18 or so percent of healthcare spending is delivered through physician services, about 15 or 16 percent through long-term care. I know you spend a lot of time thinking about prescription drugs and about the prescription drug market. I'll say a few things about that here. So typically, when we think about prescription drugs, we think about retail prescriptions. And what we see there is it's a relatively small amount, and it has been growing modestly. In this example, compared to 2016, it's risen by about 1%. But that's not the whole picture, and healthcare is complex, and I will repeat this again. But it's not the whole picture because a significant amount of prescription drugs are delivered in office-based settings, cancer medication, medication for MS, et cetera. And these are the drugs that are high in cost. These are brand name drugs. These are oftentimes biologics for which there's no competitive market, and they tend to drive healthcare spending substantially, so much so that if we took them into consideration, overall drug spending in Minnesota is closer to $8 billion and consumes about 17% of the economy. A few more words about long-term projections. So when we think about the doubling of healthcare spending, what will drive that? Primarily hospital care, long-term care, and prescription drug spending. So the areas where we spend a lot, but the areas where we also might have, as is the case in the prescription drug market, less control over pricing. What is surprising or what is remarkable is that some of the areas that consume a lot of healthcare spending are also the areas that experience a lot of growth. So you sort of have the double whammy that you start from a high level and then you see substantial growth. And this is what the arrows in the third column show. Hospital spending grew 7%, long-term care spending grew 6%. So there is a multiplier effect that will continue over time. So the next few slides, I'll show you a few data and statistics about pieces of the market for which we have data. And though Minnesota is a state with a fairly rich set of data on healthcare spending, there are certainly spots for which we have little information. So hospitals in Minnesota, there are about 130 community hospitals. 77 of them are critical access hospitals. These are facilities that are funded differently by CMS, to support rural hospital infrastructure. We'll talk about this in a second more. The hospitals are sprinkled throughout the state, but they're not available everywhere. Largest facilities, as you would expect, are in the urban areas of the Twin Cities, Olmsted County, St. Louis County. And we can present this information in much greater detail, of course, if you're interested in it. The critical access hospitals are one example of the tools policymakers use to shape the healthcare market. As I said, the CMS or the federal government through Congress has made the decision to pay for rural healthcare differently to maintain a healthcare system. To some extent, they were successful, but to some extent, it also meant that we're interfering with the market that otherwise might have not supported physical bricks and mortar facilities across the state. There are about clinics are not licensed in Minnesota, so we have some information about them, but not complete information. What we do know a fair amount about are clinics associated with hospitals, and there were about 800 clinics affiliated with Minnesota's hospitals, most of them traditional primary care or outpatient clinics that are under the ledger of the hospital, where sometimes the hospital, or where oftentimes a hospital would charge a facility fee, and then there are other offsite locations, home health agencies, other long-term services, nursing homes, et cetera. Primary care clinics, and I realize this slide does not have a lot of value because there are a lot of dots on the map, but essentially, again, we have information on a subset of physician clinics in Minnesota. These are clinics that provide primary care services or certain specialty services for which we collect quality of care. Of these, there are about 700 clinics across Minnesota with physicians employed by them. The ratio of physicians to patients differs across the state, as you would expect. On average, about 99 physicians, there are about 99 physicians per 100,000 individuals. In rural Minnesota, it's much, much lower, about 41, 42 physicians per 100,000 people versus 105 in urban areas. Another map with dots on them. I will skip over this pretty quickly. Just want to say one thing about the outpatient surgery centers, which are on the left-hand side. It is one example on how the healthcare market is changing. And it's changing through innovation, it's changing through technology, it's changing through financial incentives that are available to innovators. Over the past 10 years, so there are about 81 outpatient surgery centers in Minnesota in 2018, and you've read in the news that there is the intention of some of the medical systems to grow this number quite a bit. The number has already grown over the last 10 years by about 26. And what is interesting about this innovation or this disruption is that it changes the financial flows in the healthcare system. Hospitals have relied on procedures as a mechanism to fund their operation to some extent to subsidize certain services. As these services flow away, as a subset of these services flow away to other entities that don't have the fixed costs that our hospitals have, there are adjustments these facilities have to make and the market has to think through. Now, do we think of them as positive disruptions? Certainly in some ways, if we can guarantee high quality of care and we have insight into how these organizations work. But they're disruptive in the sense that they undermine, potentially undermine the hospital financial reality. A word on telemedicine, another disruption that you as a legislative body have had the opportunity of dealing with or have decided to shape. Telemedicine, I think many times is seen as sort of mechanism to support delivery of care in areas where physical presence of physicians or care providers is limited, rural areas of the state. I think there's a story of two cities here, of two geographies. But first off, yes, telemedicine and the use of it has grown rapidly over the past 7 years. It's grown sevenfold, but utilization is still very, very low. There's very little telemedicine remaining, and the use of it differs really across payer, across the type of telemedicine services, and across the geography. So the two stories here are in metropolitan areas. These are mostly services used by commercial payers or by enrollees in commercial plans, where rather than going to a doctor, you email your doctor and you say, I have a fever, here's what's going on with me. In the non-metropolitan, and these are so-called patient-initiated e-visits. In the non-metropolitan areas, these are more provider-initiated services that are real-time and where patients are looking increasingly for mental and behavioral health services. So this is the area, I think, that many thought telemedicine had an application in. So what do we know about how well the healthcare delivery system delivers healthcare to Minnesotans? Some, but you know, as I've said before, it's complex, and some aspects of delivery of the delivery system work really well. Others don't. Others are mixed. One thing that is that can't be debated is that healthcare certainly has grown in terms of spending, but it's also grown in terms of the engine of employment in Minnesota. Since 2000, healthcare employment has grown by about 48%. It has grown through two recessions. It has grown at a time when the rest of employment has contracted. It is growing at a rate of growth higher than the rest of employment. That's both an opportunity and a challenge, an opportunity in the sense that it delivers generally good incomes, a challenge for payers in that a labor-intensive industry tends to grow at the labor costs that are growing over time. I hope that makes sense. Healthcare employment accounted for about 15% of overall employment in 2018. And that's about 4 percentage points higher than in 2000. So a lot going on. We're trying to look into this a little bit more to better understand employment differences or employment in patient care delivery versus administrative services. But that work will take us more time. So a lot of things in healthcare delivery are really important and are going well. There are prescription drug therapies that are life-saving and that are coming up with tremendous cures. There is, of course, another side to this in that these innovations are oftentimes very expensive and sometimes so much so that they affect the affordability for many individuals, and you've debated this with insulin, of course. Air ambulances, they can whisk you away from northern Minnesota and bring you to a Trauma One hospital if that is needed. But there too, we have very little idea how prices are set. We have very little control over whether those prices are fair and appropriate. And it's a market that has surprises for anyone who takes a ride on them. Cancer treatment, there's been a lot of innovation in this space. Again, incredibly costly, so much so that it is a double whammy for patients who have cancer in that they are incurring incredible deductibles early in a calendar year on top of the anxiety and stress of having cancer and being treated. But also what has been going well and where hospitals have played a really important role, of course, in our regional healthcare coalitions, that prepare us for pandemics of any kind or public health emergencies so that we can address them and protect the population as best as we can. And the real smart people at the health department who deal with this told me, don't get into any detail. Ask the experts. And I can connect to the experts, to the real experts. But when we look at spending and outcomes, oftentimes we really have to ask, what is the value relative to the spending that we're experiencing, that we're observing? A lot of press on maternal mortality, a really embarrassing and heartbreaking healthcare statistics. I don't have Minnesota data, but what we know from Minnesota data is that sometimes we're not different, and when we're different, we tend to be different in the sense that we have much more substantial differences, much more substantial disparities by race and ethnicity than many other areas. You know, diabetes is a chronic disease. You've talked about it. That affects about 500,000 Minnesotans, give and take. We have worked a lot in this area and with a lot of creativity, but the share of the population that receives, by well-established standards, well-managed care, is less than half. And that has been pretty sticky for a number of time, for a number of years, and again, is pretty pretty disappointing. Yes, the healthcare system can fix that on its own, but there have been a lot of discussions within healthcare and outside of it, how healthcare can play a bigger role in communities and in bringing resources to patients before healthcare delivery and after. And talking about costs, maybe one more time, the high cost of care and the high increase in the cost of care has measurable outcomes among the population. So when we ask individuals, was there a time in the previous year when you didn't see care that you thought you needed? About a million people said, million Minnesotans in 2017 said that was the case. And that's about 20% of the population. What is troubling, what is particularly troubling, is that it's particularly high for individuals who are aging off their parents' insurance coverage. Those are folks older than 25. And that is highest among people with chronic disease. On the one hand, it makes sense because people with chronic disease have more healthcare needs. But the system is developed or is designed to address those needs, yet these individuals, because of the cost of care, experience higher barriers. I'll depress you a little bit more by sort of saying, by illustrating that while all of this is going on, we're spending a great share of the economy on healthcare. That's the graph on the left-hand side. About 14% of the economy is devoted to healthcare. If healthcare grows faster than the economy, this ratio goes up. And in Minnesota, we have a very robust economy that is growing faster than the rest of the nation. So we compare well, but this is a tendency that we have to be aware of. And we are paying for waste and inefficiency and fraud in the healthcare system. By some estimates, it's more than 25% of healthcare spending that goes to administrative complexity, over-treatment, under-treatment, pricing failures, fraud and abuse, etc. So, why is this all happening? Don't we have a market? Shouldn't the market deliver deliver care consistent with our values and with our expectations? Can't we direct funding where we want outcomes to shape? I would say maybe that's the wrong question. This is the wrong question for two reasons. Number one, here's a list of the expectations for a free market. And as you go down the list, and you will find not a single one is met in healthcare, meaning there is no free market in healthcare because of our needs as patients, because of the structure of the system, because of the expectations that we have for how healthcare works. And that's the second reason. Even if we had a perfect free market along the definitions that economists have come up with, it wouldn't deliver the kind of healthcare that we wanted for our population. There wouldn't be a market for care for the uninsured and underinsured. There wouldn't be a market for prescription drugs for very few people that couldn't be monetized. So every society has looked to structure the market and structure incentives in a way that the outcomes that we expect are delivered, or that the likelihood that those outcomes are delivered are consistent with our expectations. So let's go down the list for just 1 minute. Consumers don't have enough information about their health care. They certainly don't have enough information about prices, price setting, the market, alternative therapies. We delegate the clinical expertise to providers. When we are ill, when we're sick, we're not really up to make reasoned decisions about efficiency and effectiveness of healthcare. We're looking to see ourselves get better and our family members get better. Market entry, I'll have a slide on that, but the healthcare market is highly concentrated. So market entry is incredibly difficult. These are complex, costly systems. It doesn't work that way in healthcare. Sometimes there are disruptions, of course, as I mentioned. There aren't large firms selling products that are comparable. And even if they were, we as patients or consumers or employers as purchasers wouldn't be able to distinguish whether these markets are, whether these products are comparable or not. Again, there's what the economists call a real information asymmetry. And then sort of the idea of an idealized market is that individual firms can't affect market prices. And that is, of course, not the case in healthcare. You just might want to look at the prescription drug market. So how does that play out in the delivery system in Minnesota? A couple of slides on that. Looking at the hospital system where there is a lot of data, we have observed over 20 or so years that the rate of affiliation has increased. So more hospitals, fewer hospitals are independent, more are part of systems. The four largest systems on the right-hand side here, Fairview, Mayo, Allina, and Health Partners, the top three, I think, account for about half of hospital beds and half of net patient revenue. If we go all the way down to, say, CentraCare, I think we're accounting for almost 70% of beds and revenue. Does that matter? You know, to some extent you could argue, and that certainly is the argument institutions make when they are pursuing mergers, you could argue bigger institutions have better ways of managing care, creating standards, delivering better performance. The data doesn't bear that out. The only thing that where the data is really solid on is that consolidation leads to higher prices. That ultimately is one of the primary reasons for getting bigger, so that you have more market power, so that you as a firm can affect the market price. And if we look across Minnesota by region, all markets are concentrated, some moderately, some highly concentrated, and we've organized them with the concentrated markets on the left-hand side and the more moderately concentrated markets on the right-hand side. Again, maybe to address this differently, collaboration in healthcare, I think, is very desirable. Collaboration on behalf of patients, collaboration to share best practices, collaboration to innovate in new areas, for example, in the area of population health. That happens, that is desirable, we should encourage that. The FTC, when they look at mergers in the Department of Justice, they tend to argue collaboration is desirable, but it doesn't have to result in consolidation. So you can collaborate in the healthcare market, you don't have to be part of a single entity. And as institutions become more concentrated or more consolidated, both vertically, both horizontally, meaning hospitals merge with hospitals, they also have become more consolidated vertically in the sense that hospitals have acquired physician clinics, and I'm highlighting this here. Again, when we ask physicians in Minnesota whether they are working for an entity that is integrated or not, most say they work for a medical system that where the medical system owns both the hospital and the clinic. So we have that vertical integration where more and more providers are associated with one of the large healthcare systems in Minnesota. To give this a different flavor, since 2012, when we started to collect this data, hospitals have, in one way or another, acquired about 180 physician clinics. And the idea there is, of course, as more care moves into outpatient settings, it's important from a revenue perspective to control some of the revenue from flowing out. It's also an opportunity to continue to charge facilities fees and thereby maintain high levels of revenue. The healthcare system, and in this case I mean the bricks and mortar healthcare system, is not just expensive, it's also growing, and it's growing in terms of, let me say this differently, that the healthcare system invests a lot of resources in capital renewal. There's a thing on the internet that I didn't include here because it seemed too playful, but a lot of investments in hospitals have resulted in institutions that look more like hotels than places of care delivery. And sure, it's nice, I suppose, but that, I think I would argue, is a non-productive investment in healthcare. So what do we know about capital expenditures? And we know it only through commitments, not through actual expenditures, but largely these, I would expect these to be fairly equal. Minnesota is in a phase of the second or third round of upgrading birth centers, competing for parents to have their children at one facility rather than at the other. Some of the largest spending projects are about creating new facilities, hospital in Duluth, to the tune of about $800 million, $380 million for investment in Rochester, for another investment in Rochester, $150 million over a four-year period invested into upgrading and renovating outpatient clinics, and a lot of spending into tools and equipments like robotic surgery. Some of this may be productive. Some of it may be to provide environments that are safe for patients. But some of it is really medical arms race that has led to Minnesota having three children's hospitals and other inefficiencies. I wanted to talk for just a second about community benefits, sort of again as an example of how society and the legislature may decide to drive certain desirable outcomes. You can deliver community services either by taxing entities and then delivering it through either government or through nonprofit organizations, or in this case, as we've done in Minnesota and elsewhere, by exempting providers from taxes and seeking for them to deliver these desirable services through their business practices. So Minnesota hospitals are largely nonprofit, but they are operating in a for-profit environment. So when we look at the literature across the U.S., there doesn't seem to be a lot of differences in how they operate. There are differences in how they access capital, but these institutions are running a business. What is remarkable and what has been pretty stable over time, that most of community benefit really is direct patient care, what hospitals do anyway. In this case, it means charity care. It means accounting for what is perceived as underpayment for Medicaid patients. Just 1.6%, less than 2% is devoted to what we think of as actual community care, improving circumstances, living circumstances of patients, investing in population health, education, et cetera. So it's a pretty stable pattern, but I think it's not a pattern that is entirely representative of the nation. One example of the problems of the market, the way we're currently observing it, is, you know, whether it's the prescription drug market or the market for hospital services, there's just not a lot of information on how prices are established, who pays what, and why do they differ between facilities and within hospitals. Now, this is an analysis that we've done a couple of years ago, where we've looked at 13 procedures, common procedures delivered in hospitals, and we looked at what is the variation across facilities in the price for these services, and what's the variation within a facility for price of these services. So I'll walk you through this one example, total hospital-based total knee replacement. The green bar shows you that on average the price was about $24,000 in 2014, 2015. But it ranged from a low of about 6,000 to a high of about 47,000. So that gives you pause in the first place. But more interesting, I would say, is that within each of these lines that represent hospitals towards the top of the average price or towards the bottom of the average price, you still see variation in hospitals. And it's so unintuitive, I really have to explain it. Two people could go to the same hospital to get a knee replacement, and they or their peer could be paying radically different services. Why? Really, primarily because of the market power that each of their peer brings to that hospital. If I'm negotiating with a large insurer, I'm willing to and expect a lot of visits or a lot of procedures. I'm willing to accept lower prices, but where there is a provider, where there is an insurance carrier that has a small footprint in my book of business, I will demand a higher price. And that is, I think, one of the mechanisms that where consolidation leads to higher prices. The more market power, the higher prices you can demand, the more imbalanced the power between payers and providers are. You know, the study, I think, was helpful in that it showed us what we knew existed. It was not particularly revolutionary because we knew this variation existed, but we understood from it the degree of variation. It didn't quite lead us to full transparency because we as the health department cannot report on individual hospitals and what the prices are at these particular facilities. We have the data. But the statutory authority doesn't permit us to put names on these hospitals. Madam Chair, how are we doing with time? Is it, should I take another 5 minutes, perhaps?
I think that would be good. We are past 30 minutes, but.
Yeah. So I'll skip over some of these data on changes in access to services, closures of nursing homes, even though the elderly population is increasing, and move right to the question that you started out with. So what are the tools available to policymakers to impact market performance? And I see that in three categories: regulation, reporting, and what we're willing to pay for or not pay for. So many of these things are part of your daily work, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. We've also commented on them already. The legislature can regulate market entry through licensing, through other controls. The moratorium is one example. We'll talk about that in a second. You can convey a nonprofit status to providers with some oversight or less oversight. You have a role in implementing antitrust enforcement or the rules of the game, the rules of the market. Insurance regulation certainly is one mechanism, and establishing forms of all payer either payment rates or growth targets. We've talked about reporting. What I've shown you is the result of reporting that you've expected from the health department. But then the power of the purse sometimes has come into play in other states where, say, California has said, we are employing a reference pricing system for the state employees, but we're not paying for certain service or we're not paying above a certain rate. The moratorium is an unusual vehicle in the sense that I don't think it exists in that form in the U.S. elsewhere. It grew out of an effort aimed to constrain what was seen as unproductive investments in facilities and hospitals, overbeddedness, the concern that more beds would result in more admissions. It replaced the certificate of need law in the late 80s that was seen as not being very effective to constrain spending. And in 2004, you established a process to pair with a moratorium where the health department would do a preliminary review to inform your decision ultimately about whether to grant an exception to the moratorium. The moratorium essentially is about not permitting an expansion of hospital beds through the establishment of a new facility, again without an exception, or to constrain or not permit the expansion of the number of licensed beds at a given facility, and there are some exceptions in law. What we typically do is conduct a review of proposals as they come to us and then deliver a report to the legislature to highlight a number of relevant findings about the impact on other facilities, the need for the new capacity, community perspectives, et cetera. Generally, we take the liberty to share with you some general observations on the effectiveness of the moratorium. And what we typically say are the following things. We find the moratorium effectively has fixed in place historic capacity and historic market shares. What that means is if you have a footprint in the market, you will have a footprint in the market too. Others can't get into it other than through very complex activities. And to the extent that some hospitals hold a cache of licensed beds that they have not implemented, it creates a competitive disadvantage to those who don't. And you saw that maybe 2 years ago when you debated the Regents Hospital moratorium exception request. Generally or exclusively, the moratorium is a site-specific one-off approach to asking, do we need additional capacity at this place, yes or no. It is less asking is the inpatient capacity well aligned with the needs across the system? That level of planning doesn't happen through the moratorium. In fact, it might not happen at all. The moratorium only asks as a proposal. Somebody is looking to invest in an area. Does that make sense in the context of that local market and not in the context of the overall access to healthcare service, to mental health beds, et cetera. Generally also, the moratorium sort of delivers tension between the business case for adding beds, a hospital operator saying, I can make money in this area and deliver what I think are good services that maybe have a benefit to a public interest in adding beds. Is there a value of adding more resources to the healthcare system that will play out through premiums and cost share? And then oftentimes, to really make these decisions, well, there's insufficient data. So there are some real challenges with the moratorium law. And I'm happy to answer more questions on this. I just wanted to show you the history of the close with showing you the history of proposals that we have reviewed and how you as a legislative body have acted on it and whether it ultimately resulted in an expansion of hospital beds and where or not. So in short, I think two proposals were not found in the public interest. One moved forward in a different form. One didn't move forward. One proposal was found to be in the public interest but never came off the drawing board. and the other 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 ended up with an expansion of beds at that particular site. So sorry for taking so much time. I hope we have time for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Gildemeister. That is a lot of material, and I think that we could indeed go on and talk about each of these things in a lot more detail, and maybe at some point we will do that. First question goes to Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. A lot of detail there. Thank you for all of it. On page 5, we had been talking about key aspects of spending trends. And you had a graph showing the spending growth, how it's been shifted from insurers and employers to individuals. And I'm just curious, with the data you collect, do you have similar numbers for a graph on income and or profits for insurance companies, pharmaceuticals, and hospital revenues?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. Yes. So we have actually a graph that shows how household income has changed over the same period of time compared to healthcare spending for individuals, and I'm happy to share that with you. But we can also construct the equivalent of hospital revenue and another example that you raised. What I don't think we can do in a meaningful way is to associate pharma profits with it, because they would cover the whole business of the pharmaceutical companies. I don't know that we have insights on the profits that they generate from Minnesota business. So I guess we can make that comparison, but it would not necessarily be an apples to oranges comparison.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would still be interesting data, and I think when you were on page 9 where you talked about retail prescription drugs being, I think you said retail prescription and specialties and hospital drugs, when you add them together, you're up to about 17%. Is that right? So of that 17%, what is Minnesota paying? What portion of that is Minnesota purchases? I've heard 60%. Is that in the realm of possibility?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, I'd like to put some pen to paper, because there are always different ways of cutting and slicing who in Minnesota pays what. So if the question is, does the state budget, what percent does the state budget pay? Is it Medicaid? Is it Medicaid plus CGIP? Is it what goes into the bucket? But we can look to peel some of these things apart. We can do that for the retail sector. I don't think at this point. We can attempt to do it for the specialty market as well, for the hospital-based prescription drug market as well, but we have not done that yet.
So I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, thank you. If that can be done, I would be really interested in that data, and I guess I'm looking at anything that pertains to a Minnesota connection, a Minnesota government or a Minnesota entity like county services, et cetera, all of that, because we're looking at that with, just trying to get a handle on what that volume is and how we might be able to impact that. May I have a couple more questions?
Well,
how about one more?
One more, Representative Bierman. We have other members, but we could come back to you also.
Okay. I think I have 10, so if you come back to me.
Well, we'll see how many we can get to.
All right.
Yeah, I have a bunch of them too. And
all right, this last one then is page 7. You were talking about the regulated entities in healthcare costs. Could you tell me which entities are regulated as far as pricing for the consumers? I mean, is there a direct consumer regulated price? For instance, it's hard for me to even pick where to go with this, because I just don't know. I think you mentioned that some are regulated and some are not, and I'm just trying to define what's regulated mean and what is truly regulated in the whole market.
Okay, Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, so I might have been a little sloppy in my choice of words. When I talk about regulated entities, I talk about the distinctions that hospitals need to be licensed, but clinics do not. As far as I can think about it, prices or reimbursement levels at any of these entities, at no entities are prices or reimbursement levels at this point regulated. To the extent that Medicaid brings purchasing power to the market, maybe that goes 20% there. To the extent that insurance carriers establish capitation rates, but that's not really a regulated market.
Right.
I think I'll stick with my statement to say prices or levels of reimbursement are not set. Diane, will you please nod? Am I right? SNPs. I guess the exception are nursing facilities, skilled nursing facilities.
Okay.
And they're only regulated for the public sector.
Well, everybody pays the same, though, right? I'm blocking on the name. What's the term I'm searching?
Rate equalization.
Price?
Rate
equalization. Thank you. Rate equalization. So, in fact, when we have a Medicaid price, that's the price that everybody's going to pay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. I really appreciate the thorough presentation. So I had just a couple of brief questions. So with discussion of recent hospital bed closures in the news, I think you touched on this, but are hospital systems, when they're closing beds, are they allowed just to hold on to those beds without having to go through legislative approval, or what does that kind of look like?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, it's my understanding that we view the closure of a hospital or the delivery of hospital beds as a business choice. So to my understanding, there is no formal process to review it, to approve it, to disallow it.
Okay. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe, Mr. Gildemeister, during your comments, you also said that this puts other hospitals at a competitive disadvantage. Is that about right?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, yeah. So the example is, if you were a large healthcare system in the 90s when there were a lot of hospital admissions and entities held on to these licensed beds over a long period of time, a portion of them can be used in investment initiatives that system might make over time. So example with Region was Region's health partners operates Region's. That hospital does not have a licensed bed capacity. So when they want to expand that bed capacity, they have to come to the legislature to get permission. Fairview, Alina, the Mayo system generally have licensed bed capacity that is effectively parked that they can dip into.
Mm-hmm. I have one more small.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. You know, I think that we really do need to assess as a legislature whether or not we can call those beds back. If we have jurisdiction over the moratorium and over these establishments in the first place, I think it's fair enough for us to assess whether it is in the best interest of patient health in Minnesota to just let these bed allocations be a business decision. When apparently there was an inability to maintain hospital solvency in the first place. And then one last thing is, in Maryland, they have a system of global hospital pricing, caps revenue, caps growth and spending, and sets kind of an all-payer system in which hospitals have budgets, and there is no incentive to have volume-based system that rewards seeing more patients rather than keeping more patients healthy. So that's just something that I encourage folks to think about and to look into is what are these alternative models of delivering healthcare that remove profiteering while ensuring that we focus on public health. So I thank you, Mr. Gildemeister, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gildemeister, on page 5, I find that our spending is quite concerning, and we've seen this graph before, but by 2027, our spending will double to almost $100 billion. And given that in the last 20 years, the price, the cost of that has shifted to the consumer, do we have any data of what's going to happen in the next even 5 years as far as cost shifting or how in the world we're going to afford double what we're paying today?
So, Mr. Gildemeister, do you have your crystal ball? And no, can you tell us what to do? That's what we all want to know. Absolutely.
You know, I think, Madam Chair, I forgot my crystal ball in the car. I think it's a really fair question, Representative Mann. The sense in the analytic community is that the extent to which costs are being shifted to consumers has reached its breaking point. I think you've seen that in the deliberations here. We see it in our own lives. There's so much uncertainty about what is covered and how much is covered that the benefit of insurance coverage is becoming questionable to many individuals. And that is kind of an unsustainable space because it leads to patients not using medications that they need. It leads to not going to the doctor when that's necessary. It leads to making decisions that maybe have financial implications. What we're going to do collectively to shift the cost elsewhere, I honestly don't know. In last year's report on spending, we sort of went through the lessons over time from cost containment and essentially have reached the conclusion that unless society is willing to turn some winners into losers, the increasing cost of care will do that for us. It will limit access, people will step away from insurance coverage, et cetera. So I think employers are at the point where they no longer feel that they can layer more costs on individuals. Some employers are thinking about waiving cost sharing to increase adherence and increase better outcomes. But sort of what the solution is not really clear to me. Again, the research community feels there is not a silver bullet out there. There are lots of small fixes that we need to engage in, and they sort of span the space from transparency to regulation to limiting access in some instances to, coming up with ideas that we haven't even debated yet. But it's a challenge.
Representative Mann? Okay. All right. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for having this hearing today. I was just being able to get a full night's sleep after that moratorium bill that came up a few years ago, so I'll look forward to not sleeping again for a while. But just a few comments for Mr. Gildemeister and then a question at the end that you can take with this. And I just wanted to start out with, I've heard that part of this presentation before, but the comment about the hospital lobby and the hotel lobby piece. That one I always bump up against because I've spent time in my private life doing resource development for different nonprofit, not-for-profit organizations that do those types of things. And I think that the connection that you try to draw there gets missed when you're talking about the hospital lobbies and the hotel lobbies looking the same, when really a lot of the time that's done with donor dollars and the way that they're able to build that up. And that's where people want to put their money when they're doing that. And so I should have mentioned the last time I heard it, but I wanted to mention it now that that's a characterization that I always have a little bit of trouble with. On page 21, you talk about the costs going up when there's a consolidation or a hospital gets bought out. Do we have any information? I don't need it today, but if you have any information about what kind of expenses go along with that. I've been a part of now two different buyouts or mergers in healthcare systems, and it seems like one of the first things that happens is that everyone's pay gets put onto the same level, and that may have some other reason for, might be some of the reason why we have those costs going up with those consolidations. I know at least one healthcare system that actually puts their, the new employees get to be put on a pension afterwards and not just the basic retirement plans. And, you know, what kind of costs go into something like that to bring everyone up, especially at the wage level for the workers there, to keep them on par with the larger system, and how that plays into the cost piece. On page 16, you talk about the successes. The air ambulance, I just want to say that is one of the bigger things that we've really seen success out in my area with. I'm really happy to see that. In fact, I think it was the Avera Healthcare System in Sioux Falls. They actually purchased two extra helicopters last year, and one of them is just to make trips to Mayo three times a day with patients, because that's how they found the system to work well. And really glad that you were able to highlight that as a piece of it. And then finally, with the question here too that may need further follow-up, is on page 13, where you're talking about the telemedicine piece and the utilization and how that remains low. Are there any specific barriers, or is it a whole host of barriers that are leading to that utilization being low? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, thank you for the thoughtful comments. The question, I think you had two questions, at least I took one as a question. I don't think we have any insight into the expenses of consolidation. It is, unless you're at the FTC, those are the details that are not really easy to come by. I wonder if there are data that we can help to approximate it, but off the top of my head, I can't think about that. We tend to only see the piece where we see increasing prices at the end. Of course, the increasing prices to some extent are consistent with what you've said about not just pensions are aligned, but price, fee schedules are aligned as well, and that is sort of one outcome. About telemedicine, I think that's one that I have to take back to the team and ask some questions. I think there are some barriers that still remain, even though the legislature has looked to reduce some of these barriers, but I'll be happy to report back.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister, for coming to present. I have a lot of questions, so if I get cut off, I'll just take them offline later, but I apologize, Chair Liebling. We have a lot of nurses here today.
Continue the meeting like into the evening. I'm sure Mr. Gildemeister would be fine with that.
So given that we have a lot of nurses here today, I think maybe they're really concerned about some of the closures and consolidations in hospitals. And I'm just wondering if you can help answer a few questions about the moratorium and how the beds work if a hospital closes. Do they get to shift those beds that are no longer being used if a hospital closes? And how does that work? And are they able to shift beds to ICU, mental health beds? I mean, can they change the designation, or is it designated moratoriums on specific types of beds?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, what a good question. And it is the part of the question that makes me not sleep during the moratorium deliberations. So to my understanding, and I'm not an expert on that, but I will confirm that, to my understanding, a licensed bed is a licensed bed, whether it's in one place or another, and oftentimes that licensure is defined by federal standards, by CMS standards. There are some differences, for example, concerning perhaps bassinets, it's a different license, perhaps concerning beds within specially designated, by CMS designated psychiatric units. But generally, licensed beds can be taken offline, they can be moved, they can be They can take different designation, just so long as the physical capacity and space permits doing that consistent with federal regulations. So I hope that answer was made some sense. There are requirements, but a licensure is not specific to the type of care that is delivered, with some very small exceptions.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So if a hospital closes, how does a different hospital system, do they have to apply to increase their beds from a hospital closure and go through the process of the moratorium process?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, let's see if I can remember this in detail, but it's in 144.551. The way this works is that there are a number of provisions that were written into the moratorium law with its passage that ensured a few things, that ensured the ability of facilities to move beds within their campus. So say you are raising another tower, you can move it from one tower to the next. If a hospital is moved within 5 miles, to maintain the bed capacity within those two, to maintain that bed capacity even though it's not the same facility, but also to use a portion of hospital beds that have been, for which the hospital had a license, but that are no longer used. And I think it's 50% of licensed bed capacity that is unused can be used to expand beds, again, within that campus. So it's not that you can take that bed and move it across the state, but there's sort of some limitations around that. I will make sure to write that up in a more coherent way in an email, send it to the chairwoman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Do you have more?
I do. Just really quick.
Okay.
Okay. So in the community benefits, you said something interesting. When a hospital is not for profit, and they file a 990 IRS form to document their community benefits for their tax status, are those 990 forms public? And you mentioned also that they get to claim underpayments for Medicaid. Can you elaborate on that statement?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz. So a couple thoughts in response. Yes, 990s are public. And I wonder, Alicia, do we actually have them on file? We do not. But we have annual, as part of hospital reporting, we obtain annual financial statements. Minnesota has a law that requires reporting of community benefits, and that the community benefit, and that's where this data is coming from. So we can make that available. The definition of community benefit includes a number of categories, sort of broad categories like direct patient care, research and education, financial in-kind contribution, and then a number of categories of community benefits. The direct patient care includes, I think, two or three things. One is to pay for services that are, how do I say that well, that would lose the hospital revenue, sort of like an emergency room. So unless it fully meets its fixed cost, hospitals might lose a revenue by operating it, or a burn center. So in support of entities that in support of activities that would be a loss leader. Secondly, direct charity care payments for individuals, so when care is forgiven in part or in full. And thirdly, the difference between the cost of care at the hospital and the rate Medicaid pays. And those, we can break those out for you, and I'm happy to make this available to the committee as well. These definitions are not unique to Minnesota. Those are definitions that have emerged over years, and I think are also shared by the federal government in their regulation that flowed out of the, were part of the ACA.
Okay. I just have one comment, Chair Liebling. Yeah. So I think Representative Mann had a really good question about what are we going to do with the growth in healthcare costs. And I'm surprised you didn't mention how we need to change the incentives on how we pay providers to deliver care, because I think one of the big things that health economists have been promoting is we really need to align the incentives and change how we pay providers by going to direct contracting, which you see employers starting to develop with integrated health systems and global budgeting. So I'm very fortunate that I get to write a monthly column in the Minnesota Reformer, so I'm trying to put out those ideas. But I encourage you also to have your experts weigh in on that publicly so we can educate people about what we need to do to reform healthcare in Minnesota.
Great. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I also have a whole bunch of questions, but I'm not going to ask all of them because I think other members also do want to ask some more questions. But Mr. Gildemeister, first of all, I mean, I think that one of the big kind of big question beside the one that Representative Mann asked about the cost, but one of the big ones is just, you know, how do we here in Minnesota assure that that we have capacity where we need it, where patients need it around the state, and that that we have a system that actually works for patients and isn't just about money. And you know, so I'm interested in these, you know, what are the levers that we have. And the moratorium issue kind of fits into that because it does not seem to be doing much for us. I mean, I think it was supposed to hold down costs, right, by sort of stemming the arms race, so to speak, so that, you know, the idea was if we build a lot of beds willy-nilly, they'll fill and it'll cost more. And it doesn't, having a moratorium does not seem to have helped much. I'm going to ask you kind of for your opinion on this, but and it also, but one thing it does seem to do is I'm sure that it is really good for the lobbyist bottom line, because it sure takes a bunch of lobbyists to get a moratorium exception.
Preach.
And what did
preach.
Preach. Okay, preach. You know, and so there's something really dysfunctional about this thing now. It's, if it wasn't in the beginning, it seems to have become that now. It's not really serving us very well, I would say, just from my observations. And yet, you know, I don't know if we, say, if we just were to remove the moratorium and then people, the hospitals could build wherever they wanted to build. So I'm not sure that is really what we want either. So I just kind of want your opinion about that. As so that would be my first question. What maybe, and if you don't want to go there, it's fine, but I just, we've got to do something with this thing because it just isn't working very well for anybody. Well, it's working maybe well for a few people, but it's not, I think, working well for the state. Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, a bunch of really good questions, a number of really good questions. I'm glancing over to my assistant commissioner if she permits me to express my opinion. I think what I would say, Madam Chair, is the moratorium is trying to do something, and it succeeds in places and it doesn't succeed in others. You know, to the extent that existing beds have a monetary value, it certainly is an opportunity for the state to monetize it, and thereby to relieve the competitive disadvantage. So I don't want to talk about particular ideas, but at the health department, we've talked about the moratorium in a number of ways, and I think, you know, a really fun idea, I don't know if that's the right way of saying it, would be to sort of have a trading mechanism for licensed beds. That can sort of leverage some of the opportunity and some of the cost, and maybe combine it with incentives for building capacity where it's needed. So perhaps we might come back to you with some ideas if you like. I think secondly, about maintaining a system where it's needed, it's a really tough question, because I think on the one hand we're saying do not close facilities because we need to maintain a system. But on the other hand, we are saying, how can we subsidize healthcare when it's not effective and efficient? Shouldn't the market allow to correct itself? So I don't know that there's a really simple answer to that. But Representative Cantrell spoke about the idea in Maryland. and of a global budget system, and it's been implemented for some rural hospitals in Pennsylvania to take advantage of the opportunity of collaboration between payers, Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial, mostly Medicare and Medicaid, to generate predictable revenue for a system so they can plan multiple years out, and to sort of free up that system to deliver the population health that they want to do. So right now, the financial streams don't really work in a way to incentivize that kind of care delivery, but it could be built into a global budget system in a smaller space in the community, but it could also function with a lot of pain, I think, for a larger market. So there are certainly ideas, but they aren't easy solutions because problems are complex. There are demographic shifts, there are business changes, there are preferences, decisions are made by patients. You know, we go where our providers send us and not necessarily to the local hospital. So these are complex interactions in a complex system, and to find, there are no easy solutions in that complex system, I feel. But there are some good ideas out there. Some have been tested.
All right. And the second question I have is goes to the community benefit also that was mentioned by Representative Schultz. And I'm just wondering, I think that is one of the levers that you mentioned in here, and just wondering kind of what other states do with that. Is there any state that uses that as, maybe we don't have that much control over it. I'm not sure. I heard you say some of this is federal. But it's interesting to me. I didn't realize that they used the, you know, Medicaid so-called underpayment as part of the community benefit. I mean, that certainly puts in context when people complain, when some providers complain about low Medicaid rates, but then they're also, you know, using that gap as part of their community benefit. There's, you know, I'll remember to ask about that from now forward, but I do just want to know whether we could be using this better because, you know, honestly, nonprofit doesn't seem to mean much anymore, and one wonders, how can we make that mean something? I mean, and I've said this in other contexts. This is not anything that should surprise anyone. Nonprofit status is a big gift from the taxpayer,
yeah.
A huge gift. And we as a state have the right to expect something meaningful in return. And I'm not sure we're always getting that. Could you comment on that?
Madam Chair.
Throw you the hardball on that.
Really, thank you for the easy questions. I'll start with other states. You know, the tax exempt, the charitable organizations are governed under state and federal tax law. And federal committees have been, under Chair Grassley, have been pretty mad about some excesses, not in Minnesota. And so there has been an appetite of trying to fix whatever the problem is. So there's some federal initiatives. Some one piece of that is more transparency, better understanding how these resources are used. But federal law doesn't define, and state law doesn't define either, what the trade-off or what the expectation is. So yes, you have to deliver charity care, but it's not defined how much. You have to report on it. So to some extent, I think the state hasn't defined what the expectations are. Maybe because it's difficult, maybe because the state wanted to delegate that authority to the boards, to the community boards at individual hospitals. The circumstances certainly would be different at an HCMC than they would be at a small facility in northwest Minnesota. Other states, attorney generals have been quite aggressive in assessing and deciding whether what some of those hospitals have done is consistent with their interpretation of the tax laws. You know, that is certainly, that's certainly a place. But I think in fairness to hospitals, you know, there is not a lot of case law or requirement that are laid out specifically that have to be met. One of the changes that happened in the ACA is that hospitals, together with the communities, have to develop sort of a community health improvement plan. And so that offers an opportunity to ask how should the resources are better used. I think it might be worth trying to understand whether that has affected practices so far and where it has and where there are good examples.
Okay. Representative Moran, I see she's leaving. Did you? Okay. All right. Are there other questions from members? Representative Cantrell, you have one?
Yeah.
Go ahead. We're almost done, but we can finish up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again, Mr. Gildemeister, for this really incredible presentation. What I'm kind of wondering is, are there any states that have found a way to ensure that the pay of hospital system executives is commensurate with the outcomes of patients or anything like that? Because I see hospital system CEO pay go up 10-15% every couple of years while the median wages for workers stagnate for these hospital systems. Is there a way that either we as a state or other states can create incentives to make sure that if someone's getting paid that much that they're actually providing for patients, which is their responsibility?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, boy, another good question. I would think, on the one hand, we're talking about billion-dollar industries. You know, hospitals, especially large hospitals, are incredibly large industries in and of themselves. So to the extent that they feel they have to attract the executives at that level of pay and want to be competitive, I think that's one driving force. As to how the boards govern the mechanism to reward performance, that's a good question. I don't know anything about that, but boards can certainly decide, just as they do in the for-profit space, to link performance to outcomes and make other decisions about appropriateness of the gap between income levels. Maybe we'll dig around and see if we can find something.
All right. Well, thank you again, Mr. Gildemeister, and to your whole team for a great presentation and for all the good work you do. And with that, members, we are adjourned.